selling in their cars. Trouble is, the interstate highway system made suburbs possible, and those suburbs have choked not only the interstates, but the surface roads that people use to run quick errands. In some cases, just getting out of the neighborhood has become a problem. We tend to think of this as a left-right issue, with those lefties supporting transit and new urbanism and people on the right opposing it. But our guests today discovered, or at least one of our guests today discovered, that when it comes to this issue, resistance originates from both the left and the right, and he wondered why. And the result is his book, Dead End, Suburban Sprawl, and the Rebirth of American Urbanism. Ben Ross is the author, and he joins us by phone from the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
And here to provide some local perspective on what's happening with all of this are Shannon Binns and Ben Collins. Shannon is founder and executive director of Sustain Charlotte, which is an organization working for a greener region. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
And Ben Collins, no relation, is vice president of Crescent Community of the Board of Directors for the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association. And thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Mike. Glad to be here.
We have two Bens today, so I'll try to be gentle by mentioning last names as well. So Ben Ross, you're an environmental scientist and a transit advocate in the D.C. area, and you were president of Maryland's Action Committee for Transit for 15 years, which grew into the nation's largest grassroots transit advocacy group. I grew up in that area and was there when they were digging the tunnels for the metro, and I'm actually surprised to hear that there is resistance now.
Well, I think that the suburbs can be rejuvenated, but the idea of just expanding the suburbs farther out forever is a dead end.
And it can't be done because nobody wants to drive that far. And transit lines, I guess it's not economical to build transit lines out that far. I'm also curious about the resistance to transit lines in a city that is clogged with traffic and has been for years, and a city in which the metro has proven itself times over.
Right. The great majority of people have always supported the transit line that I've been working on, but it goes through a very expensive neighborhood and through the middle of the golf course of a fancy country club. And so there is has been some sharp but narrowly based opposition. The problem is that they are people with a lot of influence, and it has been a long fight. At this point, we're close to starting construction.
Well, it is not a phenomenon that evidently that is peculiar to Chevy Chase, if that's the neighborhood you're talking about. But
yes, it is.
But it's a problem that is nationwide when it comes to suburbia, which we will talk about as we go through this program. Most of us assume that suburbia really started after World War II as a way to find housing for returning vets and their families, and then the interstate highway system came along in the was authorized in the 50s, came along in the 60s and 70s, which made driving longer distance slightly easier. But we also know that in Charlotte there were so-called suburbs early on in the 20th century. Dilworth, Myers Park were considered suburbs, and now they're in these inner-city neighborhoods. But you discovered that the reality of suburbs dates back even further than that. When did they begin?
Really, in the last half of the 19th century, people started building suburbs around railroad stations. And then as the streetcars came in, they built somewhat less expensive suburbs along the streetcar lines. A lot of those are now what we think of as the city neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. And why did they do that? Was the reason because people wanted not to live in an urban environment, or were they simply seeing economic opportunity by starting businesses and living near those businesses located near railway and streetcar stops?
Well, when people had to walk to work or get a horse carriage, the city was really small and very crowded, and the sanitation was not good. So people definitely wanted to spread out from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And Ben Ross, we've witnessed this in modern times here in Charlotte. All you have to do is go down South Boulevard along the Lynx Blue Line, and you'll see where nothing used to be or where derelict factories and warehouses used to be. You'll see all these apartments. There must be, I don't know, how many units are up and down South Boulevard?
Today, there have been roughly 3,000 units developed over the past 5 years.
That's all this. I mean, even the ones that are about to come online, that's clear.
There's another approximately 3,000 units that are coming.
So there are about 8,000 apartments now.
That's right.
Where nothing used to be, and that's all in the last how many years?
About 5 years.
So could that be considered a suburb, a new suburb inside the city?
Quite possibly. Clearly, the transit line reshaped development patterns for Charlotte. Roughly 20% of all apartment units developed in the greater Charlotte area have been built along the Lynx Blue Line.
And when the Lynx Blue Line expands toward the north, and it's going to do that, mm-hmm. they've already begun work on it, do you anticipate the same kind of growth as it goes north toward the university?
Absolutely. I mean, we're within only hopefully 3 short years before that line opens, and we've already seen additional apartment development take place, and the planning for additional development taking place along that line.
And is it always going to be apartments and condos, or will we see new single family developments?
Sure. Traditionally, rooftops come before other types of housing, and so you start to see attached for sale communities, townhome communities that are being planned along that line. You see apartment communities being planned along that line, and once you get that critical mass, much like you've seen in South End, the retailers will come, grocers, and then behind that, office and hospitality.
And Shannon, this is probably like a dream come true for you because you're into the greening of America thing, at least the greening of Charlotte. Exactly what people said was going to happen along the transit line actually did happen along the transit line, and it's very compact and it's very sustainable, isn't it?
It is. But I should point out, it's not just about greening. I mean, this is, you know, socially and economically, this has huge advantages for Charlotte as well.
What way?
Well, it's providing a social need that people have. Increasingly, we have millennials, right, younger generation, who are looking for more opportunities for social interaction. We have a growing boomer population who's also looking for more social opportunities and walkable communities, many of them as they age.
And less yard.
Yes, less yard, right. So, you know, oftentimes people cite suburbs as being important because people are looking for large yards. Or good schools, but millennials and boomers aren't looking for those things. So it's meeting a very important social need as well.
And it's changing a paradigm, it seems to me, Ben Ross, that's been in place for a century at least, and that is the idea that home ownership is the essence of the American dream. It's part of our mythology. It's part of our experience. It's supported, in fact, in public policy. And you discovered that this is so much a part of our thinking that it is almost an affront to propose that the single-family house give ground in any way, any other form of housing. If I'm right about that, talk about it.
That is right. This has been built up over really a century. It's built into all of it's built into the way we fund transportation, and the problem is that 100 years ago, single-family houses were only for the upper class, and as they moved down the social ladder, we reached a point where they were pretty much where everyone lived. They started to lose their prestige, and so people who are younger don't think about, I have to have a single-family house. They're thinking, do I really want that 60-minute drive to work? It's happening all over the country. I was in Greensboro. There are new apartment buildings going up in downtown Greensboro.
Well, you know, you say that the suburbs, living in suburbia and having the single-family home with the yard and the white picket fence is about status-seeking. What does that mean, and where did that idea come from? The fact that prior to a certain year, only rich people could afford single-family homes?
A lot of it came from that, and it was, in fact, promoted by the early real estate.
Less of a stigma now, and less of a consciousness of seeking status to the purchase of a home. I don't know which one of you to ask this question of, but are you seeing that as we see these apartments and condos go up, both downtown here and up along the Blue Line, et cetera, and elsewhere in the city, are you hearing from younger people, the people moving into these places, that they really don't care about the status associated with a single-family home?
Sure. I mean, I'd be happy to take a shot at that. I think today millennials are really making, well, really all individuals are making a lifestyle choice. Millennials desire more social time, more time to interact. They don't want to take care of a yard. They're not ready to raise a family. And so they're able to have everything at their fingertips they want when they live in these walkable communities.
You say they're not ready. Does that mean at some point in time they might want to buy a single family home in the suburbs?
Absolutely. I think that generally folks are getting married later, they're buying homes later, and so we've seen this big wave of population that are aging through their 20s, and I think they want to buy single-family homes.
Because we've talked on this program in the past about this new urbanist philosophy, and people have wondered what will happen to all of these homes in the suburbs that we have built over the last 20 or 30 years or more, the far-flung suburbs. But they want to buy these houses, these 6,000, 5,000 square foot houses. Do you think they will? And if they don't, doesn't that concern you as somebody who's with Sustained Charlotte? Doesn't that worry that we'll, that if nobody wants to buy these houses in 10 years or 20 years, that we're going to have a vast...
Right. So there's always going to be a certain percent of the population that, that wants that. But what the shift that, that demographers and statisticians have noticed is that that number is declining. They estimate that the market today is roughly 25% who want that suburban lifestyle, single family home. And that's a significant drop from the past.
And Ben Ross, if that was to, so if owning a single family home was associated with status, what happened to throw the switch in the opposite direction? Why are people eschewing that and saying, I'll find my own status in other things?
I think there's a few reasons. One is that simply, you know, all economic classes now live in single family houses somewhere. Another is that things just kind of got out of hand with the commutes. I mean, it's one thing to drive an extra 5 minutes to get to work. It's something entirely different to drive an hour.
In D.C., where the subways come above ground in Maryland and Virginia once it gets out of the city, and where these lines go further out than just the downtown area of Washington, have you seen, what kind of development have you seen around the suburban stops in these metro lines? Have you seen single-family developments, or have you seen mostly condos and apartments?
Right around the stations, we're seeing condos and apartments and some townhouses. But it's very, those have turned out to be very important for the problem we mentioned before, maintaining those single-family neighborhoods, because the single-family neighborhoods that have access to a downtown nearby, you have the pleasure of the neighborhood where you can walk around having to go all the way downtown.
Let me stop you there. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNCTV's Summerfest, presenting The End of Dieting with Dr. Joel Fuhrman tonight at 8. Information at unctv.org. Social media has quickly become part of our lives. It seems that someone is always checking their smartphone. They're always posting or reading posts on Facebook or tweeting or reading tweets. We're all just keeping in touch, right? Are we really? Are we really socializing on social media? Are we forming and maintaining real connections? And have we gotten to the point where our use, not just of social media, but our phones, has become unhealthy? We will talk about that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm show, 15 states have passed new restrictions on voting ahead of the November elections. An update on states' efforts to expand and restrict access to the polls and calls for congressional action.
The Diane Rehm show is this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the suburbs and the future of the suburbs and the present of the suburbs and how transit and other accoutrement can impact the way we live. Ben Ross is with us by phone. He's the author of Dead End, Suburban Sprawl, and the Rebirth of American Urbanism. Ben Collins is also with us in our studio, Vice President of Crescent Communities and a member of the board of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association, and Shannon Binns, Founder and Executive Director of Sustain Charlotte. Just prior to the break, Ben Ross, you were talking about how in the D.C. area, which is where you live, the metro, which goes from the D.C. as a subway, from the downtown area as a subway into the suburbs of Maryland and Virginia as a surface line, have actually helped single-family neighborhoods thrive because it gives access to the downtown work area to a lot of people who would have found themselves in a parking lot on I-95 or another route into town had it not been for the advent of the metro. So these things, these transit lines, can support suburban areas.
Well, that's absolutely true. When I moved here 30 years ago, before the metro opened, the house prices got higher the closer you got to the Potomac River. Now it's the opposite. The house prices go up as you move from the Potomac River towards the metro line, and they're highest around the metro stations.
This is something we haven't heard, I don't think, in our discussions about this in Charlotte when we've talked about light rail and commuter rail. We have not heard that home values, we know that home values go up around the transit stops, and that development occurs around the transit stops, and that begins to spread out from those stops slowly but surely. We've not heard that home values go up in the suburbs where these lines extend. Why haven't we heard that? Wouldn't there be less resistance to further development of transit and expenditures on transit if people saw their property values rising in the future?
Well, I would just say we don't have a transit line going into the suburbs yet.
Because every time we talk about it,
right.
People say, not my tax dollars.
Right.
Let's not do that.
It's true. It's short-sighted, I think.
Because I know the red line is not the red line. What's the line that is scheduled to go down Independence?
That's the silver line.
The silver line.
Yes.
The silver line, some people say it ought to be a train down the middle of Independence. Some people say it's going to be bus lines at the moment, dedicated bus lines down Independence. I guess I'm curious here, Ben Ross, as to whether a bus line, a dedicated bus line, would raise property values in the outlying areas, or whether it has to be rail.
I believe that rail is much more effective at it.
Why?
Well, people see that it is, I think people instinctively understand that a rail line is, it's a first class trip, and it's smoother, it will stay there. And then on top of that, the social status works into all of this, and the bus does have a negative association with a lot of people, and you can't get around that.
And he said something interesting. It stays there. It's not going. Once you put that rail line in, it's not going anywhere. So as a developer, you can make plans. As a property owner, you can make if you're in the market to buy something, you can be fairly secure in that purchase. Am I wrong?
No, that's absolutely right. You see on the red line that's planned for North Mecklenburg County up into Lower Iredell County that many developers have made big investments along that line, hoping that that rail will come one day. And they know for certain that if that does materialize, it will come along a pre-specified route. And so you see folks both in that corridor, the rail line corridor up to the University City area, folks that are making big investments, making master plans that really pave the way for that future development in those corridors.
I want to talk about something that you bring up in your book, Ben Ross, and that is when you're planning these lines, they generally are going to impact people in single-family homes in many cases. And when these lines go in and development starts to occur, sometimes there's an impediment to that development because of the people who live in single-family homes. You experienced that with the Metro's Purple Line expansion through that golf course in Chevy Chase and some of the single-family homes. And you became mystified about how the idea that is that if you have a house, you have a veto over anything that's built near you. How did that come to be a train of thought that almost everybody buys into?
I was amazed when I researched it. It is the most bizarre historical story you could imagine. The first suburb with a homeowner association started in the 1850s as a socialist commune. And so it was just natural to have a local government and to have rules that you couldn't have a business there. And then on top of that, it was designed by some really outstanding architects, and they wanted the houses set back from the street. And so that turned out to be very popular after the Civil War. What started out as kind of a utopian community turned into an expensive suburb, and then lots of developers started copying it.
But, you know, when homeowners say they want veto power over, and we've seen this here in Charlotte, in certain neighborhoods they wanted to put a great big, I think, Walgreens or CVS or something on the corner in a residential neighborhood, and the neighbors got up in arms. They didn't want that big thing with all the cars and the parking lot in the front of it to be built. And when the Lowe's on South Boulevard was built a couple of years ago, they conformed to neighborhood restrictions to make their property look better from the street view. Isn't there something to be said as a homeowner for the right to protect your property values?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There has to be a balance. I mean, nobody would want a smelly factory next door. But a lot of this is not about property values, because clearly the commercial development that comes, you know, if you get, I mean, we have a case where I am where people fought against the development that included Tiffany's. And obviously, that wasn't going to lower their property values. So you need to find, I think we need to find a better balance between the local interest and the interest of the wider community. The local people very often will have a better sense of some of the specifics, where you need a sidewalk. They will point out problems that the developer might not have noticed. And so dialogue is almost always helpful, but too often you just get obstructionism.
You know, this is where left and right come into this. And you, new urbanists and those who support mixed-use developments and who advocate for light rail and other transit options are often seen as being people on the left, and people on the right are often seen as people who don't like the new urbanists because they're trying to force them into the kind of housing that they don't want. They want the single-family house with the white picket fence. They don't want to live in a box in the sky. And those on the right want to leave things up to the free market, but you see the left and right together on this issue in many cases. How is that possible?
Well, what I've found is that the people who don't want any development around them at all usually adopt the political color of their neighborhood, of their surroundings. So in San Francisco, the opposition to development comes from the far left of the city politics, where in Charlotte, which is a lot more conservative, a place like Charlotte, you'll find it more on the right. But it really is more about preserving, just keeping our neighborhood exactly the way it is. And so part of that is keeping the political flavor of our neighborhood the way it is. You know, you have plenty of Republicans both living in downtowns and in the development community who are in favor of new urbanism, and you have Democrats who are against it.
I would just point out, too, that, you know, new urbanism is really about giving people more choices, not less choices. It's simply saying we have a lot of land that's been zoned for single family. In fact, that's the predominant designation for most cities by far, and it's saying we also need to allow other types of housing, whether it be townhomes or you know, apartment buildings or condos, and that is what in many cases is being fought, is allowing those other housing choices to be built.
You use the Z word, zoning. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say, let the free market handle this. Don't tell me what to do or what to build or where to, or how what I can do and what I can't do. Let the free market take place. Take care of it. And Ben Ross, you say there's never really been a free market in this. And in fact, zoning rules have led to the kinds of cities that we have today. Am I wrong?
Well, that's right. One thing that the zoning rules particularly keep out that used to be very popular is a two-family house. That combines a lot of the advantages of density with the advantages of still having a yard and, you know, being close to the street and watch your kids. And yet zoning has come on particularly hard against them, especially as the rules have gotten more complicated and you need a lawyer to get anything approved. Somebody wants to take a one-family house, turn it into a two-family house, or build a two-family house, simply can't afford to get the approvals because the project's too small. So I think the zoning has been a tremendous force in limiting the number of choices we have. And where we really have to go is to have the zoning focus less on what happens inside the building and more on what the building looks like and how it's connected to the street and how big it is.
Ben Collins, you were shaking your head, nodding your head in agreement there.
Sure, absolutely. And generally speaking, folks are afraid of change. And so there's generally a great deal of lack of trust between residents and developers and perhaps the municipality. And that's something in Charlotte that we believe we've done pretty well. The Charlotte Apartment Association has stayed very engaged with the planning department. The planning department has done a very good job at times at engaging neighborhoods. You mentioned Dilworth being one of those previously, where they've come in and really listened to all stakeholders' concerns. And many times there's very significant alignment between those, and there may be several key issues that are really the hot buttons that once identified you can manage through.
Ben Ross just mentioned that dual family homes, duplexes, mm-hmm. and we have duplexes in Charlotte, and I think there's an ordinance that says on a corner in a neighborhood you can build a duplex as long as it's on a corner, and in the older inner city neighborhoods there were quads and sometimes buildings that had six or eight apartments in them. They weren't overwhelmingly large and they kind of fit in with the streetscape of the neighborhood. But we've gotten away from that. Is that because it's not economically feasible for developers and builders to build them and make a profit? Or is it simply because if you're going to live in Elizabeth, you want to live in a single-family home, you don't want to be part of a quad anymore?
I think the market has dictated that to a high degree, and also those specific neighborhoods where those types of developments would be feasible have become very highly desirable to higher income demographics, and so there has been political opposition to allowing that type of development.
Scott emails, I'm a 29-year-old married professional living and working in Uptown. The status symbol for folks my age is definitely not the single-family home on the suburban periphery. Rather, it's the cozy apartment or townhome in a dynamic, walkable neighborhood and the short commute that can be made on foot, bike, or transit. So the dynamics of status has changed for these younger people.
Absolutely. And the younger people make up a large proportion of the population. So the markets are starting to respond to that. Ben's company is one example of a company that's responding to that. And so it's very much taking a market-based approach to allow that type of development. And we just need to do a better job of enabling it.
Mm. I just want to add something, that the importance of the light rail network for your city is enormous in that area, because there's just only so much space in Uptown. And to really meet the demand for that kind of living, you have to provide it in the suburbs, but it doesn't work in the suburbs unless you can get quick transit, walk to the transit, and get to Uptown. So that, I think, is why the light rail is really a crucial element in the city's future.
Well, let's talk about this, because I having grown up in D.C., I see a lot of parallels to things that are happening here now that happened there in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and I'm curious about the impact of the metro, which is the subway system, which goes into the suburbs as essentially commuter rail, not light rail. Given the fact that there's limited real estate in downtown Washington for people if they want to live there, have you seen a proliferation of multifamily and apartment housing and condo housing along the rail lines and spreading out from the rail lines, essentially making the close-in suburbs in Maryland and Virginia parts of downtown Washington now because of that?
That's right. People now think of Arlington County and Alexandria, Virginia, as part of the core of the region, along with D.C.
Because you can hop on, you can walk to the metro stop, hop on and be, if you're living in Alexandria, you can be in Silver Spring, Maryland in 40 minutes or less, 30 minutes probably.
Yeah, yeah. It's Arlington is the biggest success story. They put the metro underground beneath an old shopping street and zoned the areas around the stations for redevelopment. And they actually, each one they did better than the one before. They were kind of learning by doing. And now it is really a tremendously lively area.
And yet, despite the success of that, I'm told, there, Ron Carley, our city manager here, who used to be the county manager in Arlington, Virginia, was working before he left on putting a streetcar into Arlington County, and there's along Columbia Pike, I believe, and there's still resistance to that, despite the success of the Metro. Why?
You know, I think people feel very threatened. A certain group of people feels very threatened by the idea that the single-family house is losing its superiority. I do think that that's a lot of the motivation for the opposition. And
Because they have an investment in that single-family house that they don't want to see decline in value? Is that what it is?
No, because Arlington, nobody's house is declining in value.
Okay.
It's a psychological investment, not a financial investment.
So they like the idea of single family being preeminent because that's the kind of housing they want to live in, and they want that available for themselves. Is that what you're
saying? That's right. They want, well, and more, everyone, you naturally tend to think that what's good for me is good for everyone. I think that's some of it.
So in Charlotte, as we see transit changing the character of the neighborhoods along the transit line, and we're talking about expanding that transit line, and we're talking about putting other kinds of transit, even the commuter rail to Huntersville-Davidson in, are we hearing the same kinds of fears from people, or do you know?
I don't think the fears are near as strong along those particular corridors. Ben, I don't know if you've heard differently, but
I think the red line is really the only transit line that is running directly to the suburbs, and there has been resistance from some of the municipalities on that front.
We have to take a break. We're going to talk more about Charlotte and suburbia in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and HealthWorks by Carolina's healthcare system, working with employers to improve health through targeted healthcare programs. It takes a partnership, working together as one. CarolinasHealthcare.org/HealthWorks. 15 states have passed new restrictions on voting ahead of the November elections. An update on states' efforts to expand and restrict access to the polls and calls for congressional action in that area coming up on The Conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, Facebook or Twitter will get you to us. And we are coming right back.
I'm Peter Sagal. Did you know that your old car can support Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? And no, I don't mean it waits until you're inside the house, then turns on the Bluetooth to call the station and donate your money. It can't do that. Though it does like to prank order pizza for the Volvo down the block. What I mean is donating your car can help pay for shows like mine. So donate your old car and turn it into the programs you love.
Call 1-866-789-8627. Or go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about suburbia and the trends toward new urbanism that have been brought about by younger people, and also the what makes it available to them is these transit lines that have begun to proliferate in certain cities, including our own. Ben Ross was in town a couple of months ago to talk about this in an open seminar with the public with our two other guests. Ben Ross is the author of Dead End, Suburban Sprawl, and the Rebirth of American Urbanism. Shannon Binns is founder and executive director of Sustain Charlotte, and Ben Collins is vice president of Crescent Communities and a member of the board of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association. We talked earlier about the high-density housing that's going up along the Blue Line in South End and the remarkable transformation of South End, both as a commercial district and as a residential district. And there just seems to be thousands. There are thousands. Not seems to be. There are thousands of apartment units going up and down South Boulevard along that line. You said 6,000, but I'll bet you in not too short order of a time, there'll be 10,000 or more. Not all of those people are going to ride the Blue Line because, let's be honest, it only goes to downtown. So, So how are we going to handle all the traffic that this high-density housing that a lot of people favor now brings? How are we going to handle it?
Well, I think what people don't realize is that it's not just the trips that the transit line takes, but there are a tremendous number of trips that you take typically now by car that you can do on foot. You walk to the drugstore, you walk out to get it to your Starbucks, and that takes off traffic even more than the number of cars is the number of turns, which are really what hold up traffic on that kind of shopping street.
Well, let's talk about what's happening in South End, because if you go off South Boulevard and you go down past the Pepsi plant and you go into those little back streets, it's astounding how many apartment complexes have been developed. What I don't see is a lot of retail in those apartment on the first floors of those apartment buildings. So the idea that those people living in those buildings will be able to walk out their front door and go to the pharmacy or go to Harris Teeter or Publix when it opens, barber to the barber shop or go to the dry cleaners, I don't see that happening.
Well, there's a balance in South End. You do see some developments that have been mixed use, but what you've seen is the repurposing of many of the other buildings in South End for retail use. And so there may be four or five apartment communities that don't have a true mixed-use component, but the example with Publix, you have four or five communities that are within a quarter mile of that new grocery store, and you can imagine the number of trips that will eliminate every week by those, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 residents being able to conceivably walk to the grocery store as opposed to drive.
Well, we talked about zoning and how certain people like zoning. Why, as we when you're building these new high density developments along these transit corridors, why isn't that part of the zoning that these buildings will have opportunity for retail on the first floor so that people actually can live in those buildings and walk across the street to go to the ice cream store?
Well, Ben and I may have different views on this, but I think that it is an important, you know, public benefit for us to provide incentives or perhaps require that type of development in these around the transit stations. But some would argue that isn't taking a market-based approach.
Yeah, and that's very true. I mean,
but isn't that what the people want? The people moving into your apartments, don't they want that?
They absolutely want walkable retail, and whether that exists in the first floor of an apartment building or exists immediately adjacent, mm-hmm. Either way is walkable for the resident. And so you've seen mixed-use communities in South End develop. We were the developer of one of those communities today post-South End, where we had three or four retail stores, shops within the development. The reality is there's probably another 30 shops that our residents would be able to walk to in addition to those specific ones. And mixed-use development is a complicated issue. It does drive up the cost of housing. There's additional parking that's required. There's additional cost associated with incorporating those uses. And ultimately, the retailers are not going to pay additional rent to offset that cost. And so what that does is drive up the cost of the housing for the folks that live there. In some instances, that's absolutely the appropriate thing to do, and some it's not.
Mm. And this high-density housing in Charlotte now is not just happening along the transit lines. We are seeing apartment complexes and condominium complexes cropping up in the far-flung suburbs, but not without resistance. Am I right about that or wrong about that? Because it seems to me that Ballantyne had a recent issue with an apartment project being built out in that area.
Sure, there's still resistance to multifamily housing. I think generally there's a stigma about who an apartment resident is and what that brings with it. And the reality is that the face of the and the demographic of the apartment resident today just is continuing to change. People, both millennials, baby boomers who are wanting to move out of single family homes into condominium complexes. That's a phenomenon that has rapidly changed over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years.
So outside of the light rail line and other transit lines that are being developed and talked about, where are these new opportunities for this new kind of housing actually showing up in Charlotte?
Sure. I mean, and you see it in neighborhoods where there are many times already retail, already employment, already walkable amenities. Our Crescent South Park development near the South Park Mall is walkable to dozens of restaurants, and we believe that will be a very highly desirable place for folks to live.
Is that the tower that's going up on Oh, I can't think of the name of the road now.
Yeah, we're
give me the name of the road.
Yeah, we're right behind Piedmont Town Center, which was a mixed use development that we developed right off of Fairview, and so.
So it used to be office buildings and other places, and now it's going to be apartments.
Correct.
And condos. Correct. Is it condos and apartments?
Just apartments.
Okay.
Just apartments.
Why just apartments? What's wrong with condos? Do people not want to live in condos? Because there are a lot of apartments going up, and a lot of these condo projects downtown have been converted to apartments.
They have, and really it's a market-driven issue. It's still very difficult for condo buyers to secure a mortgage. And so today, particularly with millennials, they desire two things. One, a very active and social lifestyle, and two, flexibility. Buying a condo is not incredibly different from buying a single-family home in that you're setting down roots and really tying yourself to a specific location, whether it be within a city or even the city itself. And so as millennials are growing and wanting to take advantage of the opportunities that might exist for them either in other parts of Charlotte or other parts of the world, renting really allows them that flexibility.
This issue is an emotional one for people on both sides of the issue. And Ben Ross, you say it's not just about suburbia versus the city. It is also about individual neighborhoods that have developed brands. I never thought about this, but I think you're exactly right. Explain that.
Well, you have the whole economy has changed since 50 years ago. You go into a clothing store, it used to be you felt the cloth when I was growing up. Now you look at the logo, and I think that that's affected housing too. You have kind of the inner city hip neighborhood, the kind of funky neighborhood, and then you have the old style big house, big brick house neighborhood, and people have become very defensive about the brand of their neighborhood. And that, I think, has contributed a lot to this resistance to change that we see.
And they like their neighborhood, and they don't like the adjacent neighborhood or the neighborhood across town and wouldn't live there because it doesn't have the qualities that they perceive their neighborhood to have. And we do witness that here in Charlotte. Give me an example of what that means. Why would people like one neighborhood over the other and never want to move to that other neighborhood?
Yeah, well, the people who live in the funky in-town neighborhood wouldn't dream of living in the neighborhood with the big six-bedroom houses, and vice versa.
Well, John emails, I'm a 27-year-old who has lived in Southend and Matthews, but now I'm happy to own a single-family home in Plaza Midwood. This provides me with the benefits of a single-family home while still having a similar nearby amenities as I did in Southend and a less than 10-minute commute to work. I think that the urban lifestyle is appealing to my generation, but it doesn't have to be in apartments and condos alone. Talk about that.
That's an absolutely great point. And in Charlotte, we've seen the values of homes in these in-town desirable neighborhoods skyrocket over the last decade. And so there's absolutely a shortage of supply for folks who want to live in those in-town neighborhoods. My wife and I fit that same category. We bought a single-family home in an in-town neighborhood, and we are able to walk to all the amenities that we want to have on a day-to-day basis. And it was absolutely a lifestyle choice. But there aren't enough of those homes for everyone who wants them.
Sally emails, I live in the South Boulevard Woodlawn area and use the light rail whenever I can. I have a real concern about the type of development along South Boulevard. To me, it has an old Bedford-Stuyvesant Brooklyn look, like someday it will be Charlotte's new rough neighborhood. It's just row after row of stacked-up apartments with no apparent green space and or space for small businesses. What happened to the zoning there?
That's a little bit, the reference to Brooklyn is a little bit behind the time.
Brooklyn's a vibrant neighborhood.
Bedford-Stuyvesant just had its first few million-dollar house sales.
But it had to go through renewal. There was a point in time when that was a rough area.
Oh, it was a very, very rough neighborhood. But this is a national trend, and we're just moving in the opposite direction now. I would be frankly more worried about the far out great big five bedroom house, because if that neighborhood loses its attractiveness, You know, you have an expensive commute and you have a big heating bill or air conditioning bill, I guess, in Charlotte. And I think that the future social problems are more likely to be on the fringe of the city than in these infill neighborhoods.
Shannon.
I was going to say, to some extent, this has to do with our land use policies and what we enabled along the Blue Line. And we're having the same issue now with the Blue Line extension. We're behind in terms of planning the land use for those areas adjacent to the Blue Line extension. And we're seeing some what I would consider inappropriate development happening that is not transit oriented.
But we didn't decide to do this Blue Line yesterday.
Exactly.
We've had years to talk about
this. We have.
So why are we making mistakes like this?
That's a good question.
If in fact they are mistakes.
Right. I think we're, this to some extent falls back on government, a local government, not planning far enough in advance. A prime example, I think, to kind of bring to light is our organization tried to bring to attention a plan to by a local car dealership to use some land, a large parcel of land, very near one of the planned Blue Line extension stations in University City, right near the IKEA, that was zoned in part of a master plan for that area to be housing, multifamily housing, which would have been ideal given its proximity to the station. But the developer wanted to turn it into a large auto mall with multiple dealerships, low density, basically parking lots for cars. We told city council we didn't think that fit with what had been planned for that area. But because the plan had not been updated to reflect the Blue Line coming, city council voted unanimously to support that rezoning request, and a large dealership is going to be built very close to a walkable transit station. So I think that's a prime example of why land use planning needs to be ahead of the curve, yeah. We have a lot of work to do there here in Charlotte.
Take the train, buy a car. we're also building a streetcar line in Charlotte. Is the change that we've witnessed being brought about by light rail going to happen along the streetcar line, which is scheduled to go from Johnson C. Smith University down Trade Street to the hospital and then make a left and go out toward Plaza Midwood?
We absolutely see that as a future growth corridor. There's no question. I think that corridor in particular, the timing of that line is less certain, and so you see fewer folks making big investments in front of that line. So the more certainty that comes with that line, there's no question that there will be significant economic investment along.
So Ben Ross, in cities that you know about where streetcars are the rapid transit or the fixed rail transportation alternative, do we see the kind of positive signs of growth in those areas?
I think it depends on the specific route of the streetcar. Some cities have built streetcars that really don't serve a good transportation function, connect the convention center to downtown, but don't serve the local population. And those have been less successful. On the other hand, Portland, Oregon has been, their streetcar has brought a tremendous amount of development because it serves a really useful transportation function. It ties the new area on the edge of downtown in with the center where you have two light rail lines crossing. So, with transportation, there is no substitute for good planning. If you build something that nobody's going to ride, it won't work. But where they're properly planned, the streetcars can make a big contribution.
Shannon?
I'll just add that that's going to happen here very soon with the Gold Line with our streetcar. The first phase that is being built right now and expected to be completed in spring of 2015 will connect the Blue Line downtown to these East Charlotte neighborhoods and West Charlotte neighborhoods that it will eventually run to. So there will be a connection downtown where these two lines will cross. And to the point you made earlier, Mike, when we only have a single line, as we have now with the Blue Line, it only goes one place, downtown, and therefore it's not going to be used that much. As soon as people can take it downtown and then hop on the Gold Line, the streetcar, and take it into, say, Plaza Midwood, they've got more destinations to go to.
I have 10 seconds or 15 seconds. This is an inevitable transformation. This is happening and will continue to happen as the millennials become the workforce, correct?
It is inevitable, but it can be done well or it can be done badly.
And it takes city leadership and local business leadership to make it happen.
And are we doing it well, Shannon? Here?
We have room for progress.
Shannon Binns with Sustain Charlotte, Ben Collins with Crescent Communities, and Ben Ross, author of Dead End, Suburban Sprawl, and the Rebirth of American Urbanism. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Dixon Hughes Goodman LLP, a CPA and advisory firm headquartered in Charlotte, over 1,700 professionals in 30 offices serving clients in the U.S. and around the world. Details at dhgllp.com.
On Weekend Edition, we go behind the headlines and put the week's news in context.
If you say Obamacare, they know what you're saying. If you say Affordable Care Act, they walk by without any ding, ding, ding. Then we throw out the word penalty. Zoom! They've never heard that before.
And, of course, we're here when news breaks, too. It's Weekend Edition, Saturday and Sunday from 8 to 10 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
So tomorrow we talk about social media. Are we really being social on social media? Or is it simply distracting us from being connected to others? We'll take a look at that tomorrow morning at 9. Today, nice weather. Sunny. High should be in the mid-80s, lower 60s overnight under clear sky. I think the rain is gone for a while. Sunny tomorrow with highs in the mid-80s as well. And at the moment, we are at an even 80 degrees. Diane Reams coming up next at 10 o'clock on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE Charlotte, 90.3 WFHE Hickory, Charlotte's NPR News.